Ian doesn't say a lot. That's kind of natural when you're two. But sometimes he comes out with a word that just takes his dad's breath away.
Well, we were sitting at the back with a bottle of Coca-Cola, and we found it in the fridge, someone left it here, and my daughter was talking about Coca-Cola, and suddenly my two-year-old, who can't even say his name as yet, it's a very simple name, like Liam, suddenly turned around and said, Coca-Cola. And everyone was absolutely flabbergasted. And we laughed, so he thought it was very funny, and ran around for 2 or 3 hours saying, Coca-Cola.
Whether we like it or not, we all grew up with Coke. But there wasn't always an always.
Wealth, large sums of wealth.
Don has got this piece to earn billions. What is it like to be the richest man in the world?
That's something that I feel great about.
Hi, citizens. Welcome back to The Night Air. I'm Brent Clough. Tonight's script was brought to you with the help of Microsoft. But this hour of the Logo Agogo show wouldn't be possible without the enormous presence of Coke and Nike. So just do it and enjoy.
It all began with a gentle, morphine-addicted chemist, John Pemberton, practicing in Atlanta, Georgia. Before Coca-Cola, he invented something called
French wine coca, which was an imitation of a very popular French drink called Vin Mariani, which was a Bordeaux wine with an infusion of coca leaf, which everybody drank, including Thomas Edison and Sarah Bernhardt and the Pope, you name it, they drank Vin Mariani. So Pemberton made this imitation. Then Prohibition hit Atlanta, which is where Pemberton lived, in 1885, and Pemberton decided that he had better turn his drink into a non-alcoholic beverage, which is how Coca-Cola came into being.
Mark Pendergrast, author of For God, Country, and Coca-Cola.
The two principal ingredients of it that gave it its name were the two principal drug sources, coca leaf from Peru and the cola nut from West Africa, one of them having cocaine and one of them having caffeine. Pemberton himself was a morphine addict, and one of the reasons that he was interested in cocaine was that people thought that it was a way to get off of the morphine habit.
John Pemberton died 2 years later. Meanwhile, another Georgia chemist, Asa Candler, got control of Coke. His great-great-granddaughter, Elizabeth Candler Graham, says Asa was hoping for a cure for his migraine headaches. Asa had a lot on his mind.
He grew up during the war between the states. He had suffered a great deal of poverty because of that war. He also came from a typical yeoman farmer background of the Deep South at the time. They were staunchly Protestant, and he had been raised, as so many Southerners of his day were, with this absolute devotion to family, God, and community. He also had been raised, as most Methodists of his era, to believe that you were supposed to always be working and then using the profits that were considered to be God-given for the betterment of your family and your community. And Asa truly lived that, was the embodiment of that his entire life. He never wavered from that. He was also one of those people that probably did not require a lot of sleep. He had an eye for new inventions, and his great strength was marketing. He believes in advertising and getting the message out, and that's one reason that he's been known as the father of Coca-Cola.
Oh, mother, you wouldn't know your child. Oh, mother, I'm getting awfully wild. I am drinking Coca-Cola now. Every minute, I just go to limit. Oh, mother, you wouldn't want me home. Cannibals compared to me are mild. One night I went to a cabaret. A lady danced and showed her lingerie. I told her she could call me at the old YMCA. Oh, oh, mother, I'm wild.
Well, Well, they had a drug image for a very good reason, because it had drugs in it. But at first, in the mid-1880s, everybody thought that cocaine was a wonder drug. That was the time that Sherlock Holmes was taking it in the fictional stories. Sigmund Freud was taking it and writing wonderful descriptions of how great cocaine was at precisely the same time. However, by 1900, it was quite clear that cocaine in its pure form was not a good drug, that people eventually would become addicted to it. It was not a good thing. Coca-Cola never had a huge amount of cocaine in it. It was just the natural constituency that came from the fluid extract of coca leaf. The caffeine was what was addictive and still is. However, Coca-Cola was tarred with the same brush as cocaine, and there was a tremendous amount of pressure for them to take the cocaine out. And they eventually did around 1903, which did not end the controversy surrounding the drink. By that time, one of the nicknames for Coca-Cola was dope. For instance, my grandfather owned a drugstore in Atlanta, and he told me that you would order a dope with lime or a dope with cherry. As a matter of fact, you could also order a shot in the arm, and that was a Coca-Cola. And to this day, the sign language for asking for a Coca-Cola is to mime giving yourself a hypodermic shot in the arm.
About a man named Samson in the Bible once we read, how to tip a mountain over was a snap for him, it said. The wise men claimed his source of strength was in his hair so long, but scientists have since found out that this belief was wrong.
Now we found that he'd been drinking Coca-Cola, delicious and refreshing Coca-Cola.
Now the doctors all agree, if a Samson you would be,
you can gain strength by drinking Coca-Cola.
But Asa didn't really need drugs. He was high on religion, and he wasn't alone. Religious broadcaster Rachel Cohn believes that to understand the man, you have to understand his time.
Today, capitalism is often regarded as the enemy of religious values. When it was actually emerging and assuming some of its modern contours in the 19th century, a German sociologist, Max Weber, actually tried to discover its religious origins. So he looked at how capitalism was in fact a kind of a response to a religious theology, and he found it in Calvinism. Essentially, a good Protestant would fulfill his calling, and he would do it in the world. That is, although one was not meant to enjoy the luxuries of the world in the sort of Puritan lifestyle, which emphasized a rather ascetic life, it was sort of forbidden him to escape the world, and therefore one's calling or the fulfillment of God's task would be done within one's workaday life. And success was regarded as the indication that one was truly fulfilling God's calling.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because in the heyday of the robber barons and the capitalists such as Andrew Carnegie, there was this notion that God smiled on those who made lots of money. There was some sort of magical connection between the wealthy man and the deity, the idea being that he must deserve it because God had given it to him. And Asa Candler certainly had that feeling and made a lot of speeches to the effect that God and capitalism went hand in hand. Candler himself was an evangelical Christian who would get so worked up at revival meetings that he would become physically ill.
It's a little hard for me to describe that to someone unless you have seen some of these revivals where people just become so enthralled by it, just become very emotionally overwrought, and he would. It was somewhat characteristic of Asa himself and members of his family. They tend to be prone towards a touch of depression, and there was a very emotional side to this man, which is hard to reconcile with the fact that he could be very hard-nosed in business, very pragmatic, and very single-minded about his company and his product.
It won't take you to heaven, but it makes you want to go there. Anybody else who wants a touch from God.
When you have a faith like he did, you don't get sidetracked, and he was never sidetracked. He believed in his product as he believed in his faith, and he believed that what he was doing was good, for America, good for the world, that he was able to take the profits from this business and then plow them back into worthwhile projects, mostly projects supported or endorsed by the church. And I think it was that discipline that he learned by following the Bible literally that allowed him to develop a discipline for his business. And that was part of his success.
Old Asa would end sales conferences leading his salesmen and singing Onward Christian Soldiers. Then they hit the road again, spreading the word across the land.
Follow me, girls, to the fountain where the soda water flows, where the drugstore clerk makes the Coca-Cola sparkle and fizz and
But Asa's selling techniques were mild compared to the guy who was to lead the sales force in the 20s.
Harrison Jones was his name. He was a big, burly, larger-than-life fellow with curly hair that sort of boiled out of the top of his head. He was the kind of person who would almost assault you with his personality. He was violently obscene in his manner of speech. But at the same time, a lot of people mistook him for a Baptist minister because he spoke so much in an evangelical tone. He called Coca-Cola holy water. He also informed his sales group, hell, I could sell bottled horse piss. So take your pick.
He pointed to two clips fastened on the instrument panel of the car just below the windscreen and, reaching into the glove compartment, took out a pack of small cards. He selected one and slipped it beneath the clip. It read, "If ye have faith, nothing shall be impossible unto you." Matthew 17:20. He removed that one, shuffled expertly through the cards, and with one hand as he drove, selected another and placed it under the clip. This one read, "If God be for us, who can be against us?" Romans 8:31. "I'm a traveling salesman," he explained, "and I drive around all day calling on my customers." Norman Vincent Peale's bestseller, The Power of Positive Thinking. His book's full of homilies about businessmen and prayer power. Recently, addressing a Chamber of Commerce annual dinner in a southwestern city, I noted a man in the audience who seemed to be scowling at me. It was altogether possible that this facial expression was not in any way related to me, but he seemed antagonistic. Before starting to speak, I prayed for him and shot a series of prayers and goodwill thoughts in his direction. As I spoke, I continued to do this. When the meeting was over, while shaking hands with those around me, suddenly my hand was caught in a tremendous clasp and I was looking into the face of this man. He was smiling broadly. "Frankly, I did not like you when I came to this meeting," he said. "I do not like preachers and saw no reason for having you, a minister, as speaker at our Chamber of Commerce dinner. I was hoping that your speech would not be successful. However, as you spoke, something seemed to touch me. I feel like a new person. I had a strange sense of peace. And doggone it, I like you."
There were many Christian businessmen's clubs, and they evolved a kind of a network of entrepreneurs, businessmen, and there are some other attitudinal connections. In the Protestant world of the 19th century, there was a great deal of focus on missions. America really evolved great missionary endeavors when they were dying in England and in Europe. So the approach of selling something, of spreading it as far and wide as possible, would, I think, fit very well with a businessman's aim, which is to essentially sell his product as widely as possible.
Candler's brother, by the way, was a Methodist bishop, quite well known, and the author of all kinds of books. saying that the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant was superior to everyone else in the world, and that the function of capitalism was to keep the worker in his place.
He was a formidable preacher. He rose quickly through the ranks and became one of the prominent, perhaps the most prominent, Methodist bishop in the Southeast at the time. He had also been a bishop to Cuba and South America and had served for a short period of time in China. It's an interesting thing about Warren and Asa. They were able to work together for 30 years. Asa had total control of the Coca-Cola company, which allowed all of that profit to come into his hands and his hands solely. The benefit for the Coca-Cola company is that when Warren gave his approval of it, in other words, it was a non-alcoholic beverage and it was okay to drink this, the Methodist Church, and it was vehemently opposed to the use of alcohol for any reason, this increased sales. It became an acceptable, sociable thing to do for Protestants in the South. Also, Warren's influence on Asa was tremendous when it came to directing how Asa spent his money. When they needed to raise money for a Methodist project or a community hospital, something like that, Warren would run it like a revival. And Asa would be the one who would sort of set up the frenzy with, it was almost like a gambling thing. You know, he'd say, well, I'll give $100,000 if somebody will match it. And they'd keep raising the money and raising the money. And it became quite a frenzy, but they worked very well together.
Receive your healing right now. Thank God, hallelujah, glory. Sister Patsy, raise your hand. God's going to do it for you.
Drinking rum and Coca-Cola, go down for Kumana. Both mother and daughter working for the Aki Dollar. Oh, beat it, man, beat it.
Let's face it, it's hot in Cuba. The weather is hot. It's very humid. The people there needed a refreshment. They needed one that did not contain alcohol. And one of the things that Warren brought with him when he went to Cuba to preach was also Coca-Cola. And with Coca-Cola came Asa, and again, Asa's money. And that's how they were able to spend money for Methodist missions in Cuba and in Central America.
You vex me.
Asa never once saw this as a regional drink. Once he saw that it was acceptable in the South, he wanted to move it throughout the United States, and once he had achieved that goal, he then wanted to see that Coca-Cola was available throughout the world, because he truly believed that it was a refreshing, wholesome drink. For all of their exposures throughout the world, they both became well-traveled, certainly were educated, and yet in some ways they remained very provincial in their outlook. They still ascribed to the so-called Puritan work ethic. They felt like if more Cubans could come to understand that view of the American life, that so-called Puritan or Protestant work ethic, that they would be a more successful community.
Coca-Cola, neither do we say Yankee Dada. We sang Rama Coca-Cola, happy mother, both mothers and brothers, working for the Yankee Dada.
The following logo is brought to you in livid color. Zero, the total soft drink. It's zero for no calories, no carbonation, no coloring, no flavoring. Zero, the total soft drink. Let's all sing.
Zero, no calories.
Good close look at the bottle. See those millions of tiny bubbles? They're in the glass. Zero has no carbonation, so all it can do is fill you up. Of course, Zero has no annoying aftertaste either, since it contains none of those ersatz icky sweeteners. Next time you take the gang to the beach, bring along plenty of Zero. It's the only drink you can serve warm. Remember,
Zero, no calories.
And we'd like to thank the makers of Zero for sponsoring this evening's embossed logo limited edition of your favourite radio program, The Night Air, the choice of the Zero generation.
good fine time drinking rum and Coca-Cola. Pour down Point Cumana. Told mother and daughter, working for the Yankee dollar. Oh, Peter Pan, Peter. Since the Yankee come to Trinidad, they got the young girls all going mad. Young girls say they treat them nice, make Trinidad like paradise. Drinking rum and Coca-Cola, go down Point Cumana. Both mother and daughter, working for the Yankee dollar. Oh, you vex me, you vex me. From Chickachickery to Mona's Isle, native girls all dance and smile. Help soldier celebrate his leave, make every day like New Year's Eve. Drinking rum and Coca-Cola, pour down Point Cumana. Both mother and daughter, working for the Yankee dollar. In old Trinidad, I also fear the situation is mighty queer. Like the Yankee girl, the native swoon, when she hear der bingo croon. Drinking rum and Coca-Cola, go down Point Cumana. Both mother and daughter, working for the Yankee dollar. Out on Manzanella Beach, G.I. romance with native peach. All night long make tropic love, next day sit in hot sun and cool off. Drinking rum and Coca-Cola, go down Point Cumana. Both mother and daughter, working for the Yankee dollar. The fact. Rum and Coca-Cola. Rum and Coca-Cola. Working for the Yankee dollar.
The timeless harmonies of the Andrew Sisters bringing you a corporate theme tune from just before the moment when the free market liberated the whole planet.